You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Syrian troops chase Islamic State out of Palmyra and declare that their offensive is not yet finished. Is this perhaps the beginnings of an end? And if so, then what? My guests Mary Dajewski and John Everard will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including...
I don't think that Europe is a safe place. No, I don't. I think there are a lot of problems in Europe that are very, very severe.
Yes, him again. Donald Trump declares that Europe is intolerably dangerous for Americans. Who is listening to him? More to the point, why? Also ahead, Ireland commemorates the centenary of the Easter Rising. How should countries acknowledge ambiguous history? And what right does Brazil have to tell Israel, or any country to tell any country, who it can and cannot dispatch as an ambassador? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and John Everard, former UK ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both back to the programme, and we will start in Syria, where it has been a bad few weeks for Islamic State. Several of the group's senior commanders have been killed by American airstrikes or special forces operations, and over the last few days, IS has suffered its most severe territorial reversal as Syrian government forces have retaken the ancient World Heritage listed architectural treasure of Palmyra, and with it Palmyra's military airport and a key staging post on the road linking Damascus with the east of the country. Mary, with the caveat that everything is relative, how happy should we be about what is clearly a victory for the somewhat difficult to love pairing of Assad and Putin?
Well, if I'm speaking personally rather than the sort of great geopolitical context, I would say that we should be extremely pleased indeed, because the chief enemy here should be seen and generally has been seen as Islamic State, and any reversal for Islamic State, in particular as bigger one as this appears to be, should be welcomed. Now, I know that there's a problem for a lot of people, and in particular for the British and American alliance, with the fact that, as they would see it, the wrong people turfed them out.
The celebrations from London and Washington have been muted, I think it would be fair to say.
I think it is fair to say that, with the single excuse that David Cameron is on holiday, and that there has been a small voice from London of congratulations, which comes from Boris Johnson, the mayor, who, as a classicist and not a member of the government, could express his congratulations without it being seen as a sort of prime political statement.
John, it's on balance, you would have to say, a good thing to see Islamic State suffering reversals. A loss like this, the loss of a prize which they had made much propaganda sport from when they took it last May, how damaging is that to their credibility as an organization and putative state? Does this make them, I guess, a less enticing prospect as far as potential recruits go?
Let's not get too excited. They've lost it today, it's true. But Islamic State have lost territory in the past in the face of overwhelming firepower, as was the case in this operation by the Syrian army, and simply bided their time, counterattacked, and retaken. Islamic State really can't afford to let Assad sit in Palmyra. There will, at some stage, be a counterattack. And remember that last time that Islamic State attacked Palmyra, the Assad forces simply melted away. There was almost no resistance. Taking a city is one thing, holding it is another. There's another angle here, that despite all this talk about ceasing operations in Syria, it's quite clear that the reason that Assad's forces took Palmyra this time was because of massive Russian support. And Putin has taught this up. He's made clear that Russia made the key contribution. And by so doing, he has stuck a flag of Russian prestige on holding Palmyra. This means that Russia cannot afford for Islamic State to retake Palmyra, which leaves us with two irreconcilable forces at work. I suspect that what we're going to see over the next several months isn't going to be the neat eastward sweep that Assad has us believe in. I think it's going to be a very dirty, hugely destructive, ding-dong battle over central ground, which neither side can afford to lose.
Mary, as I mentioned there in the introduction to this, in parallel with this territorial reversal, Islamic State has suffered several reversals in the upper echelon of their management, thanks to American airstrikes and indeed, it appears, special forces operations on the ground. I do not, by and large, subscribe at all to any conspiracy theory of human affairs, but are we likely to learn, do you think, several years hence, that there actually was a measure of coordination between Washington and Moscow?
Well, I think that what we actually know and what has been allowed to be known, rather than what may actually be the fact as well, is that certainly there's been two levels of cooperation. One of them has been in the air over Western Syria, because initially it looked as though the Russian intervention was going to be extraordinarily dangerous, with the possibility of clashes not just with Turkey, one of which did actually happen, but with the United States. And very quickly there were mutual talks between the armed forces at a very high level with an agreement about how to avoid this. The other thing that's been going on is equally high-level talks behind the scenes, largely led by John Kerry and his Russian equivalent, Sergei Lavrov. And they have been talking hugely about what they would see as the prospects for a settlement. And this is partly linked to the Geneva talks, but it's also partly linked to a lot of horse trading, I think, and a recognition by the Americans that the Russians have in some ways called the situation in Syria rather better than the Americans have, in particular by not underestimating the possibility that Assad could come back with or without help, but also the weakness of what the West calls the moderate rebels.
John, just to follow up the point you were making there earlier, and you're quite right that Islamic State have in the past bided their time and then taken back territory they appear to have lost. But this time, as you also observed, the difference appears to be Russia's utterly sort of uncompromising use of air power to support Syrian troops, which was not a factor when Islamic State walked into the place in May. If that makes it impossible for them to retake Palmyra, and it is a horrible, fate-tempting thought, but might that make them more likely to counterattack outside Syria and Iraq, as it were, like that, by which I mean in Europe or indeed in Russia?
Yes, I think counterattacks outside Syria and Iraq are likely, but they have to prevent. At the moment, there's nothing very much between Assad's forces and Raqqa, the ISIS capital, just an awful lot of desert. ISIS have got to halt that advance. You can use overwhelming air power to launch, to support an assault on a target, to support troops defending a target, unless you actually know the positions of the attacking force is actually much more difficult. And ISIS are excellent at camouflaging their position. So it's not clear how far Russian air power would be useful in defending Palmyra against ISIS as opposed to taking it. There's another important point here. It's quite clear that Russia was trying to disengage. It's looking to me as if Russia is being slowly drawn into an ongoing conflict. And I'm old enough to remember the early days of the United States intervention in Vietnam.
Indeed the Russian intervention in Afghanistan.
Yes, indeed. That's another example. Neither of which, of course, were supposed to last more than a few weeks, were they? Just clean, clinical, surgical airstrikes and, well, the rest, as they say, is history. And I have this sinking feeling that I've seen some of this before.
Well, as a British Prime Minister, I think it would have been Harold Wilson said of Northern Ireland that he could get the army in 24 hours. It might take rather longer to get them back out.
Yes.
We should look at Europe and Islamic State, because in semi-related news, Islamic State's attack on Brussels last week and on Paris last November have prompted an outburst by Donald Trump, fat-headed even by the formidable standards he has already established, despite the statistical certainty that any given American is far more likely to be shot at work or school at home than on vacation abroad. Trump has declared Europe to be not a safe place and suggested that his country country folk should keep out of it. Sentiments we can be glad were not uttered by Franklin Roosevelt circa June 5th, 1944. Mary, the thing I don't understand about... well, if I start talking about things I don't understand about the rise of Donald Trump, we could be here a while. But why would it play to his base of extremely patriotic, proud Americans to suggest to them that they should be too scared to go anywhere?
I think, actually, it is a very long-term and deep-seated attitude across America. It's frequently, the point is frequently made of how few Americans relative to Europeans actually have passports and ever leave the continent of North America. And so their view, often even when they do travel, is that this is very alien and potentially extremely dangerous territory, even when it is absolutely, absolutely safe. So I think that, you know, he's playing to a gallery, but also to prejudices which run very deep across a lot of America. At the same time, you have to say that although infinitesimal number of people have been directly affected by the various incidents across Europe over the last 12 months, nonetheless, the overall picture that suggests, say, once a month, several dozen people are going to get killed in a terrorist attack. This is not, it's not something which
works.
Recommends it, unfortunately so.
John Kerry, the Secretary of State, John, while saying that the American presidential election was becoming, frankly, an embarrassment on the international stage, he did also suggest, however, that Americans should avoid crowded places in Europe, which is a preposterous suggestion, isn't it?
Well, the federal government has a responsibility to protect its citizens overseas. And like every other government, or at least every other Western government, it issues travel advice. And if you know that there's terrorism around in certain places, you do your best to issue advice that minimizes the chances of your citizens getting caught up in it. Avoiding crowded places, one likes to think that they don't sort of avoid all the interesting fairs and the mass things that go on in Europe. But it, on the face of it, that's not completely stupid advice. The trouble is, of course, that that will be read, as Mary just said, by a lot of Americans as a clear indication that Europe is dangerous and that they will stay home, which would be a great pity.
But Mary, on that thought, doesn't the global nature, the self-evidently global nature of the current terror threat make calculations like that fairly redundant? I mean, if it could happen anywhere, you might as well go anywhere.
Yes, this is absolutely true. And you could also say that some of the safest places are likely to be the places which have suffered immediate attack because the security arrangements will be so much reinforced. But I think that with or without advice, Europeans and a lot of other people are actually acting on what Donald Trump said. Because, for instance, my sister works in the travel business, and visitors to much of North Africa, Egypt, most of the Middle East, and a lot of the of Eastern Europe, and including Turkey, are incredibly down. And the whole focus of tourism within Europe for next summer and winter is going to be Italy, Spain, and the Canary Islands. And everybody is fleeing from the places which have been hit, and you can understand why.
Although, I mean, John, is it a question of the difference, the slight difference in the nature of the terrorism that, for example, I lived in London for a long time, and during the 90s, through any number of IRA campaigns which involved London, there did not seem to be any noticeable shortage of tourists while this was going on?
Well, no. ISIS have perhaps succeeded even better than the IRA in capturing the public eye. I mean, media coverage of these atrocities has been worldwide and instant.
There is, of course, now more media than there was in the 1990s.
I think that's an important factor. Also, there is the atrocity is slightly different. Suicide bombers in the middle of crowds with belts filled full of nails is there's something different from actually blowing up a building, which is what the IRA tend to do more of. But yes, it is a worrying phenomenon.
Mary, what's your sense of how European leaders are acknowledging this outburst? Do you get the impression that European leaders are basically just keeping quiet in the hope that Trump doesn't win, so they don't actually have to think about what having to deal with him as president might be like?
Well, I think you put it better than I could. I was going to say that I think that by now a lot of European leaders are actually tuning out. They've heard enough of Donald Trump. They know pretty much what he's going to say. And outrageous as it's going to be, I think they're going to wait until after the convention to decide whether this is somebody serious that they need to that they need to discuss and decide how to deal with. And by then, of course, Donald Trump may himself have moderated what he's saying, because what you're looking at the moment is going after the base. When it comes to the conventions and the election proper, then we're into a proper match, and the candidates, as it is, tend to move to the centre.
And John, I guess the same question to you from your point of view as a former Foreign Service officer. When it looks like a fairly extraordinary shift may be about to occur in the leadership of an important ally, what kind of preparations would foreign services across Europe be making now?
A lot of people will be analysing Trump's statements very carefully, also looking back over what he's actually done, you know, what kind of leadership style he's demonstrated in the various companies that he's run. And they won't be in the public domain for obvious reasons, but there will be quite a lot of kind of plan Bs for, you know, if we get a President Trump and how we are going to respond to this man. I would love to be a fly on the wall on some of those conversations. Sadly, I'm out of the job.
But what kind of contingencies can they discuss? What kind of practical suggestions can they pass on to their foreign ministers and prime ministers and presidents?
It'll be things like, how quickly do you want to get in there and actually have a face-to-face with President Trump? When you do that, yes, I can see the queue around the block. Yeah.
Still part of me can't believe we're having these conversations.
Well, yes, I can sympathise with that. But also, what kind of things are you going to say to him? What kind of, where are his triggers? What kind of things does he respond to? If you've only got limited time with him, which is likely to be the case, what are the key issues you're going to try to change his mind on? Can his mind be changed, or is he deeply dug in? Those are the kind of things that we're discussing.
Okay, well, on that still somewhat surreal thought, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mary Dejewski and John Everard. Coming up next, Dublin and the 100th birthday of a terrible beauty.
From Monday the 11th of April, tune into Monocle 24 for a special week of features, interviews, new programmes and more from Milan. With the latest news from the design industry, as well as a guided tour of the best running routes in the city, Monocle 24's new show, The Rundown, will give you a head start every day during Salone del Mobile. Then get your running shoes on and put what you've heard into action by joining Nike's world-class coaches and pacers for an exclusive morning run on Tuesday and Thursday, starting at Nike Space at Via Orobia, Quindice. As well as all that, our Monocle team in Milan will also be there until the 15th of April, broadcasting live, meeting top designers and good friends, and having plenty of fun along the way. So come running with Monocle and Nike, tune in to The Rundown and join our team for the latest from Salone all week on Monocle 24.
Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference returns this April for 3 days of great conversations, inspiring panellists and peerless hosting. Set in Vienna, the conference will pull together people who care about running better businesses, brands, design studios, cities and even nations, and who are looking for global inspiration and new benchmarks for success. Up for discussion will be the future of communication in a world overwhelmed by digital content, how to make a nation. Monocle is launching this brand new book in Austria and will be bringing some star names from diplomacy, government and business to explain how good countries can deliver on quality of life for all. And we'll hear from players from around the globe who've discovered that you can create jobs and wealth with downtown ateliers and the sound of the odd hammer. Speakers such as chef and food writer Bill Granger, co-founder and director of Vienna Design Week Lily Holein, and the journalist and writer Gianni Riotta will share the stage with Monocle's editors and many, many more. Running from Friday afternoon to Sunday, with a focus on a full Saturday schedule, the conference is designed as a live event with elements broadcast here on Monocle 24. In between the debates, there'll be plenty of time to meet the editors, speakers, sponsors, and also your fellow readers and listeners. For more information and tickets, visit monocle.com. Be part of the discussion at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2016 from April 15th to the 17th. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Dijewski and John Everard. Now, 100 Easters ago, a smallish group of rebels staged a chaotic insurrection in downtown Dublin. The Irish Volunteers and the Republican Brotherhood and associated militias had banked rather too heavily on the idea that England's difficulty, specifically the First World War, might indeed serve as Ireland's opportunity. Their revolt was crushed, but nonetheless, the Easter Rising was commemorated across Ireland this past weekend as a painful but necessary step towards Ireland's independence. Mary, is that a fair reading, do you think, 100 years on of Easter 1916?
Well, I think, yes, I think it probably is a fair reading. I gather, though only from reading and at one remove, that the commemoration celebrations this time around are actually sort of less gung-ho and less belligerent than they have been in some recent round number anniversaries in the past. But I have to say that I'm quite sympathetic to the celebrations in Ireland. And I think it's interesting and instructive that it's taken pretty much all of this century for the British to look across at Ireland and to see there a fully independent sovereign state and treat it as a grown-up country. And by extension from that, I look across at Russia and Ukraine, and I see the parallels there. And I think that Britain, for instance, can be very harsh on the way other countries deal with their problems, when actually we have a lot in common with that. And I just hope that it takes Russia less than a century to reach the place that the UK now is at in relation to Ireland.
All of which makes me think of a quote I was trying and failing to pin down before we came on air. It's one of those probably apocryphal ones that gets attributed to Winston Churchill, who was said to have said of Irish history that the English should learn it and the Irish should forget it. John, what did you make of the tone of the coverage? Because there is, of course, as there is with most foundation myths, and it's actually quite close in many respects to my own country, Australia's more or less contemporary foundation myth of Gallipoli, in that everybody knows the official myth, and I think everybody subscribes to it on official occasions, but everybody also knows that there was more to it than that, and a lot of the more to it may have been somewhat less glorious.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think there are interesting parallels between the Australian foundation myth, I like the phrase, and that of Ireland. It is a foundation myth, and of course, you know, Ireland couldn't not celebrate the centenary. Nevertheless, I suspect that the planning meetings for this commemoration were quite agonised, and you can see the result. Singing Danny Boy, which is about as non-controversial a song as you can come up with. Very careful inclusion of all communities. Very sober kind of speeches. Not a lot of chest thumping, not a lot of banging drums. A recognition lying just under the surface that the uprising, of course, you know, glorious in the official Irish narrative, wasn't really that glorious at all. That
especially not at the time. It wasn't even terrifically popular.
Absolutely. Nearly 500 people died for something that was probably eminently avoidable. You said it was necessary in your introduction. I'm not so sure. When the uprising took place, most of Dublin was simply taken by surprise. They had, you know, they had no idea these people were going to try and take over the country at a time, of course, when their own sons and brothers were fighting in the British forces against the Kaiser. It didn't actually go down that well. What changed, of course, was the great act of idiocy of the execution of the rebels. If that had been handled better, then Irish history might have been on a smoother course. Worth remembering, too, that before the First World War, there were extensive talks about the Irish problem, about what kind of devolution you would give Ireland. Because what most Irish nationalists at the time wanted wasn't independence. It was something like what Scotland has got now. Own parliament, own money, I think, was in there somewhere, and a certain amount of local government away from Westminster. Had that uprising not taken place, there's every reason to believe that that process would have rumbled forward, and that sometime not long after the end of the First World War, there would have been a much more peaceful, much more modulated shift of power away from London to Dublin, and a lot of people who had to die at the time would still be alive.
Final thought on this one from you, Mary. Are there you know, exportable lessons, if you will, from the Easter Rising? John mentioned the famous historical error of the British in putting the leaders up in front of a wall, but did it demonstrate the foolishness of creating martyrs in other contexts as well?
Well, I think that everybody who, I mean, you know, you look at the French and Algeria, and you say creating martyrs is absolutely, you know, it's the first and last lesson that everybody needs to learn from this. But I think it's more difficult than that, because you look with hindsight of a century and you say, yes, it was wrong to create martyrs, and that led to everything that followed. But the problem is there is also politics at home, and the pressure from domestic audience, whether to execute or to punish, you know, we can see it today with the whole issue of terrorism. It makes it much more complicated, and it is a very strong, confident government, probably a prime minister who is not all that bothered or thinks it worth taking a less strident action, even if it costs him his job. This is something very, very difficult to do. I also think that defeat is something that Britain, for one, finds very difficult to understand. You look at Japan, you look at Germany. Germany's handled this better than almost anybody else. But you look at the controversy, the domestic political controversies that defeat stirs in those countries. We don't see that. We have the Imperial War Museum and everything is fine. Everything is clear. A lot of countries don't have that, and it makes life very, very complicated.
Well, finally, tonight, one might imagine that Brazil and Israel, of all countries, would need to go a fair way out of their ways to locate the necessary contestable ground for a diplomatic spat. They have managed, however, after Brasilia refused to accept the credentials of Jerusalem's nomination for ambassador, whose politics they disliked. Israel has backed down and found the unwanted plenipotentiary a post as consul general in New York. John, this is the arena in which you used to very much work for a living. How unusual is it for a country to refuse an ambassador just on the grounds that, frankly, they don't like him personally?
Not unusual at all. It happens all the time. And the reason that we know about this case is because Israel stupidly has gone public on it. If you present your candidate as an ambassador to a receiving country, you need the agreement, the agreement of that country to that ambassador. And it happens much more than people realise, that quite simply the country turns around and says no. Traditionally, you don't explain. You just say no and that's it. And you scurry around and find yourself another candidate.
And it's all in private.
It's all in private. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Yeah. These things never get into the public domain. If you've got a close relation with the country, you've probably been told in advance that the person you're about to put forward is going to get turned down, so you don't put yourself in that position. Or you might be able to find out a bit more about why he or she was turned down. But traditionally, like I said, you don't explain these things. And it's a big issue. In London right now, a lot of the super rich are desperately trying to get themselves diplomatic status so they can avoid prosecution. There's a case which has been over the media for the last couple of weeks of a rather wealthy Arab gentleman who has put himself forward as the representative of St. Lucia to the International Maritime Organization, and is therefore a diplomat and is therefore covered by diplomatic immunity. Now, the International Maritime Organization accepted his credentials. They would have been entirely within their rights to say, don't be so stupid. And a lot of people, I think, rather regret that they didn't do that. One other point I wanted to make on the Central Israeli case here. You notice that rather than find should we call him the offending candidate, the one the president has turned down, another ambassadorial appointment, they've made him a consul general. Consuls general don't need agreement, so that unless the New York City authorities sort of kick up a real fuss, he's home and dry and out of the limelight. A nice slide.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. John Everard and Mary Dijewski, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's music next with Carlotta Rebello, then at 1900 Hours, The Culture Show with Rob Bound, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I think I'm right in saying I'm your host for that one as well. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.